This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
When we walked into the door, there were supervisors there. My sisters went in one direction, and I followed my older brothers. And the supervisor asked me to follow him to the third floor. The hallways were long and dark. The dorms, it was one great big room. It was cold, really cold. It was really uncomfortable during the day and the night.
It's as if he's back there. John Jones remembers the dark corridors of the Alberni Residential School, a boarding school on the west bank of the Somas River on Vancouver Island, British Columbia. The place Jones was sent almost six decades ago when he was just 7 years old.
The supervisor handed me a brown bag and clothes that they issued, and proceeded to walk me into the shower room where I was told to get undressed, and a whole bunch of white powder was put on my head and all over my body. And I was asked to shower and then told to change into the clothes.
Jones is a member of the Nanus First Nation, a small community of Coast Salish First Nation people in British Columbia. From Canada's birth as a sovereign nation in 1867, all the way through the late 1990s, Canadian churches and later the government operated Indigenous residential schools like Alberni. More than 150,000 Indigenous children passed through the system, a system later exposed as rife with neglect, abuse, and death. In fact, the residential schools had one primary purpose: cultural genocide, according to a 2015 report from Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They cite Duncan Campbell Scott, former Deputy Minister of Indian Affairs. Scott ran the residential school system from 1913 to 1932, and in 1920 he said, quote, "I want to get rid of the Indian problem. I do not think, as a matter of fact, that the country ought to continuously protect a class of people who are unable to stand alone. Our objective is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politic."
A friend told me not to speak my language or talk about tradition, because if you do, you will get punished.
John Jones remembers one of the first lessons he learned at the Alberni Residential School in 1962.
I could understand my traditional language, but I couldn't speak it at the time. And one of the things that we had to do was watch the supervisor strap our friends with a strap that was made out of a fire hose. And it would not just be on the hands. So we had to watch that. And to this day, I can't speak our traditional language. And I think it's because of watching my friends getting strapped for speaking their language.
When seeking models for its residential schools, the Canadian government looked south. The U.S. government had established a series of missionary-run Indigenous boarding schools decades earlier. The church's work received a major boost from the 1819 Civilization Fund Act, and by 1823, the American government was funding more than 30 boarding schools across the U.S. In Canada, the residential schools were administered by the Catholic, United, Anglican, Methodist, and Presbyterian churches. Staff were frequently poorly trained and had limited supervision. The 2015 Truth and Reconciliation report found that, quote, "Child neglect was institutionalized. Students were prey to physical and sexual abusers," something John Jones experienced again and again.
Boys sometimes peed their bed, and the counselor would make us form two lines facing each other with our belt in our hands. And as each of the person that was being punished for peeing the bed, we would have to whip them with our belt as they passed through the lines. I chose not to whip my friends, and as a result, I had to go through that line and get whipped myself. And each time that punishment took place, I chose not to whip them, but to get punished with them. I seen one of my friends with a chocolate bar, and I asked him where he got it, and he said he got it from a male supervisor called Mr. Plint. And so I went and asked him if I could have a chocolate bar, and he said he hasn't got one, but if I go back while everybody's asleep, he'd give me one. So I waited for everybody to fall asleep, and I went to him, went to his office, and he showed me into his bedroom that was attached to the office, and that's where the sexual abuse happened.
In 1995, Arthur Plint pleaded guilty to abusing 18 children. At sentencing, Judge D.A. Hogarth described the abuses as the worst he'd seen in his 45 years on the bench, calling Plint, quote, a sexual terrorist.
I don't know how long that lasted, but I know I threw the chocolate bar in the garbage, and I took baths 3 or 4 times a day to feel clean, and it didn't help.
Though almost 60 years have passed, John Jones still remembers the searing loneliness, the pain that came with being separated from his family. His parents had had no choice. For nearly 7 generations, almost every Indigenous child in Canada was forced to live in the residential schools.
I learned as an adult that if my parents didn't send us, that they would be possibly looking at a jail sentence.
Jones often wrote home, some happy letters, some sad letters. As a child, it confused him greatly why his mother never asked about the sad ones.
I thought she didn't love me anymore. As an adult, I learned that they screened our letters, all our letters, and my sad letters didn't make it home to my mom. But I think my stepfather knew what I was going through. And he had a talk with me one day, and he started telling me about his experience at Port Alberni Indian Residential School.
The same school.
And I started crying, and he reached his hand over to me, and he said, it's all right for human beings to cry and show their pain. He just held my hand for a long time.
The Alberni Residential School closed in 1973. There had been 5 residential schools on Vancouver Island. And earlier this year, at the site of one of those schools, First Nations investigators found the remains of 215 children in unmarked graves. Weeks later, 751 more unmarked graves were unearthed at a former residential school in Saskatchewan. The discovery is tragic, but not a surprise. Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission estimated that more than 3,200 children died at the schools. Ken Watts, a First Nations elected chief, told the Times Colonist newspaper that, quote, people knew that a lot of children didn't make it home. But these aren't just stories anymore. This is real. This is solid evidence that the horror stories they say are true. So, slowly, that truth is being unearthed. But what about reconciliation? Well, John Jones is 65 now. He's a father, a grandfather, and a great-grandfather. He was also involved in the first civil lawsuit against the residential schools that was launched back in 1997. The Canadian government and several churches, with the exception of the Catholic Church, have since issued apologies. But Jones says reconciliation truly begins not with a statement, but with an action.
One of the things I asked for was for a representative from the government or the church to come to our place of ceremony, where our life is, our traditional teachings, and made an apology. I think I would be able to accept that a bit more. That's how I was taught traditionally on how to make things right so that we can move on in life.
John Jones. He's a member of the Nanus First Nation and a survivor of the Alberni Residential School in British Columbia. As we mentioned, the Catholic Church has not yet apologized for its treatment of Canada's Indigenous children, and the Catholic Church ran the most residential schools of any denomination in Canada. But recently, the Canadian Conference of Bishops announced that Pope Francis will meet in December with representatives of Canada's three biggest Indigenous groups. They will meet at the Vatican. So when we come back, we'll talk about what meaningful steps to reconciliation look like and what Canada's experience says about the dark history of Indigenous boarding schools in the United States. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're talking about the dark history of Indigenous boarding schools, or residential schools, in Canada and in the United States, about recent findings and what meaningful steps towards reconciliation actually look like. Well, joining us now is Cynthia Wesley Eskima. She joins us from Orillia, Ontario, and she's chair for the Truth and Reconciliation, for Truth and Reconciliation, I should say, at Lakehead University. Cynthia, welcome.
Hi there.
So you heard John Jones' story just a few minutes ago. I'm wondering how closely that reflects experiences in your own family.
Oh, well, I guess I'd say it's almost identical to many of the people that I know that actually attended residential schools. My mother went for 8 years. My stepfather went for 12 years. He started when he was 4 years old, and he also experienced many of those kinds of experiences, sexual assault, some of the physical violence, the loneliness, you know, being a small child in a very strange place and being treated very, very harshly. Also contributed to his life as an adult with a lot of domestic violence and a lot of alcoholism.
Did they ever talk about it later?
You know what? Instead of talking about it, they lived it, and I lived mm-hmm. it as a child of those of survivors. I lived it. I don't think they really understood in the moment how the impact that that experience had had on them. I started to talk about it as I got older and started to learn more about it. Obviously, they knew they went to residential school. I don't think they really understood the psychological, emotional implications of that. They just acted it out.
Right. And I mean, I think what makes that even sort of a deeper truth is that we can't underscore enough that this was happening to what every Indigenous family in Canada for seven generations. Families did not have a choice to whether or not their children were going to be sent to these schools.
No, that's right. And so the thing that a lot of people do not think about necessarily is the parents who were left at home. When you took their children, where did you leave them? And of course, the sense of loss was matched. You know, you take a four-year-old from a mother, She's going to feel that very profoundly. And then caring for the next, you know, like if every child you have, you know it's going to be taken away from you at 4 to 6 years old. Where does that leave you emotionally? And of course, at the time, remember, it wasn't like everybody had birth control and could say, well, I'm not having any more children. And in fact, some parents actually kept having children, so there were always children in the house. So there's so many different implications from that.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the piece that we played there, I quoted a First Nations chief who said that the recent discovery of hundreds or more than 1,300 unmarked graves holding the remains of children around just a handful of schools actually comes as no surprise. So can you talk about that for a little while? I mean, were you surprised when the graves were discovered?
No, because I've been working with this particular concern for a good 40 years. And I was well aware and had talked to many survivors who had experienced the loss of friends. Some they thought maybe went home. Some they knew had been injured or were very sick. And they knew that, and some of them had to help bury them. You know, some of those children were actually, recruited to actually dig the graves and actually make sure that those children were buried. So there was no mass graves. People keep thinking there were mass graves. There wasn't. No, I wasn't surprised at all because we knew. The problem that I think really we feel most strongly is that nobody believed these stories until they actually had this visible proof. And that hurts a lot because many of these survivors were very clear in the stories that they told to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and told to their family members or spoke about at various points. People just didn't believe them. In fact, the first brothers, the Blackwater brothers in BC, they went forward to talk to the courts about this, were called liars. They were told they were lying, that this couldn't possibly have happened. And they had to continue to go back and back until they were finally vindicated and their case was heard.
Wow. You know, so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission estimated in 2015 that there were more than 3,000 children who died at the residential schools. There's already been the discovery of 1,300 graves from just a couple of schools, just a small fraction of the schools that were in Canada. So does that 3,000 number seem like a dramatic underestimate to you now?
Well, it will be because there's about 140 Indian residential institutions. Really, they weren't really schools, were they, across Canada. And at least 128 of those schools have been actively involved in this finding process. We know that at the National Center in the archival work that we've been doing, we've identified well over 4,000 names of students that were either died at the school or died shortly after they arrived home because they were infected with tuberculosis or they'd been grievously injured. So we expect that the number will probably. So we also know. Let me also say we also know that almost 50% of the children that went to these schools sickened and died. So we know that the numbers are going to be quite large and quite extreme. And really, for us, the important thing is that they be found. And that they be acknowledged and that we take action as a country to make sure that we create some restorative justice here.
50% of the children who went to the schools sickened and died eventually. So there's what, 150,000 children who went to the schools for those seven generations? So you're talking about 75,000 children?
75,000 children, yes.
And then sickened of what and died where? Perhaps many of them at home?
So some, you know, quite a number of children died of tuberculosis because they kept these children all crammed into rooms. They slept in the same dorms. They were exposed to each other at all the meals. And so they were passing on this disease on a constant basis. That's where Indian hospitals came from. They established Indian hospitals to do experiments with some of the drugs on some of these children and on some of the adults to see what they could do about it. But it also meant that the experimental process also probably killed some of those children. They died of that. They died of influenza. They died of brutality. I mean, many of the survivors talked about either being kicked downstairs or being hit over the head. And so many of those children died from brutality, and they were buried on site. And quite often parents did not know where they were buried. And quite often parents didn't even know they were dead until after the school year had been completed and their children did not return home.
But it's also, do we know that many of those children who died, did they die upon returning home, you know, having been, having fallen sick at the schools?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
People need to understand too, that a lot of these children never got home simply because the government did not provide the resources to the parents to get their children home. So if the parents did not have the money or the wherewithal to bring their children home, they didn't see them. Sometimes for 10 years, they stayed at the school.
Forgive me for asking, but I think it'll help us understand sort of the depth of actually the knowledge that has been out there about these horrors and atrocities, you know, amongst Indigenous communities in Canada, and the rest of the world is now paying attention more closely. But how is it that that you know that 50% of the children who went to the schools died?
Oh, mostly because of the records. So we know, the records were kept by the federal government, by the churches. You know, those are in the archives. So we know children died. It's actually marked. The question, what we didn't know, is where were they? You know, were they buried at home in their own communities? Where were they buried? We also knew that many of the children were buried at the schools. In fact, at Kamloops, the Kamloops school identified the fact that there were 50 children buried. When they were actually did the work, they found that 215 children were buried there. So now we're trying to figure out, okay, who are these children? We'll be checking DNA. We'll be matching those records against the records that we already have. So we have fairly good records, and some of the churches are now turning their records over. They were very reluctant to do so for the longest time. We've been back and forth with a lot of the archives to get those records into the National Center archives. And so now we're going to be able to do that, and we'll be able to do a lot more matching of names and deaths and locations.
So we're going to talk a little bit more a bit later in the show about the steps that have been taken, the steps that haven't been taken, especially since 2015 when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's report came out about residential schools. But I wonder what you make of the Canadian government's immediate response in the aftermath of the discoveries of the unmarked graves of these children. I mean, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau did tweet out that this was a dark chapter of Canada's history. What's your response to how the government has responded thus far?
Well, I think it's more than a dark chapter. I think it's a very long story, actually. I think this government has actually been quite responsive since they came into office. They've said yes to doing this work and to providing the resources for it. They've said yes to creating the travesty of child welfare. They've said yes to governance and restoration of a jurisdiction and authority. So I think this government has done its best to actually be responsive. I know the Conservative government that was just prior just said no. When we asked them about doing an inquiry for missing and murdered Indigenous women, Prime Minister Harper said it wasn't on his radar. So we have a government right now that has said, we want to see this happen. We want to do whatever we can to support it. I think we should take advantage of that as much as possible across the country and insist that the resources be up, because there really isn't enough money that has been put on the table to actually accommodate 140 schools. And we have 632 First Nation communities across Canada. That doesn't include the Métis, where about 400,000 people who are also sent to these schools, by the way, and the Inuit community of about 70,000 in the north that also attended these schools. So there's a huge, we have 2 million people, for using round numbers, that want some answers from this government. And this government is going to have to respond in the affirmative to ensure that we get to where we need to go.
Well, we are talking this hour about Indigenous boarding schools, Indigenous residential schools in Canada and the United States, especially in the wake of the discovery of unmarked graves of dead children in at least several of these residential schools in Canada. And you're hearing Cynthia Wesley Esquimaux. She's joining us from Orillia, Ontario. She's chair for Truth and Reconciliation at Lakehead University. And Cynthia, hang on here for just a minute, because we do need to talk about what happened here in the United States and its role as well in the Canadian residential schools. So joining us now from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is Regis Pecos. He's co-director of the Leadership Institute at the Santa Fe Indian School and former governor of the Cochiti Pueblo. Regis, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello, Magna.
So how closely intertwined are the stories of these residential and boarding schools in Canada and the United States?
They're inseparable. What we hear in the heart-wrenching stories are very similar to what we know. However, the full extent of the impact with the discovery of these unmarked graves is not yet known. But the reality of the stories that have been reflected over time, over generations, are very, very similar. And it is tragic, and I believe that is why the United Nations, in its Declaration of Indigenous Rights several years ago, define these kinds of acts upon our respective governments to be among the worst crimes against humanity when these are children. Imagine this kind of infliction and impositions and abuse upon innocent children. Mm.
As we mentioned before, the United States was actually a model for the schools when they opened up in Canada. Can you give us a sense as to, in the United States, how many Indigenous children went through the system here? And how many schools were we talking about?
If you can imagine that in 1860, the first Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding school was established on the Yakima Indian Reservation in the state of Washington. And as you follow through this timeline, according to the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, who is focused on this kind of discovery of the facts related to this time and the impact, by 1926, they estimate that 83% of all Native children were in the system. So with the hundreds of boarding schools across this country, one like at the Albuquerque Indian School that was established in 1881 by the Presbyterian and transferred to federal control in 1884, the establishment of the Santa Fe Indian School in 1890. Over the decades since that first school that was established in 1860, hundreds were established throughout this country, all built upon the mantra that the way you kill language and the way you kill culture is to remove the children from their language and their culture and deny those children their language and their culture.
So the intent was the same then. It was that cultural genocide that we talked about.
Absolutely.
Did the boarding schools in the United States also see did the children there experience similar abuses that have been uncovered in Canada, the neglect, the abuses, and death even?
You know, in 1990, the Santa Fe Indian School, which became the first tribally controlled school under the Self-Determination Act in 1975, did an interview with among the oldest who at that time were in their 80s, 90s, and close to 100 in a commemoration of the reflection of their experiences. And the one story that I think epitomizes an answer to your question is a 90, almost 100-year-old grandma from Jemez Pueblo who told about federal agents coming to the Pueblo and the grandfather begging the federal agents not to take the grandson at a time of harvest and instead volunteered this grandma who was telling this story of removing her from her grandparents, her family, community, dressed in her finest, and one taken by wagon to a train in Albuquerque.
Regis, I have to cut you off. We'll hear the rest of this when we come back. I'm so sorry about that, but we'll be back. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the history of Indigenous boarding or residential schools in Canada and the United States and the intergenerational impact those schools had in what has subsequently been called acts of cultural genocide on Indigenous peoples in both countries. We're going to take a look at what meaningful steps to reconciliation look like as well. I'm joined today by Cynthia Wesley Eskima. She's joining us from Orillia, Ontario. She's chair for Truth and Reconciliation at Lakehead University and governing circle chair for the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation at the University of Manitoba. Regis Pecos also joins us. He's with us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, co-director of the Leadership Institute at the Santa Fe Indian School and former governor of the Cochiti Pueblo. And Regis, I apologize for having to cut you off there right before the break. We're unfortunately beholden to the clock, but I wanted to give you a chance to finish your story.
This story really ends with the 98-year-old grandma arriving at the Santa Fe Indian School, but similarly, one, the loneliness of the experience, his stories, looking out the window every day to see a cloud of dust that might represent her grandpa coming for her. The very heart-wrenching and deeply emotional stories of these elders reflecting upon that time and wondering if they would ever return home.
Mm. So what strikes me here is, as both of you have been saying, there has been a long and deep knowledge of what happened at these schools for a couple of centuries almost amongst Indigenous families. And our collective larger nations in Canada and the United States are now only recently beginning to take steps towards full acknowledgement more broadly and the hard path towards reconciliation. So that's what I want to talk about now with both of you, about what has happened in Canada and the United States and what still needs to happen. So first, let's just quickly listen to Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who apologized to residential school survivors in 2017.
It is my hope that in apologizing today, in acknowledging the past, and asking for forgiveness. That as a country, we will continue to advance on the path of reconciliation together.
So, Cynthia, that is a statement of apology from the Prime Minister. But in 2015, 2 years before that, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada put forth more than 90 action items that Canada as a nation should take towards actual meaningful reconciliation. How many of those action items have been undertaken in Canada?
Actually, a significant number. I've actually had occasion to talk to the Minister of Crown Relations and asked her that very question. And she tells me that 87% of the 94 calls to action that they were given and that Prime Minister Trudeau committed to have actually been, some of them have been completely fulfilled, and many of them are in process of being fulfilled. So she said they actually addressed 87% of them.
Does that sound, from your experience with Indigenous communities, does that sound like the right number, or is it the government putting gloss on their efforts?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a combination of both, because the government has to make some very specific steps forward, but they're not responsible for all of them. Many of them are also the churches are responsible, the education mm-hmm. systems are responsible, the child welfare systems, the business community. So their job is to actually oversee and ensure that there's something going on in each of those areas. I think that they've done some things, like the citizens' oath is one of the things that they've had to respond to very directly, and they have that in the works. They've actually given royal assent to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. So there are some very fundamental pieces that have actually been done, and the rest of it is really more overseeing. So the child welfare piece, for instance, I did as the Minister's Special Representative across the country for 3 months on the Minister's behalf, and the goal is to get the standards changed there and actually provide resources directly to the communities for prevention. So these things don't happen very quickly because the communities themselves have to do their part, and they have to be ready to receive that and actually put in place the structures. So that's the other thing that's happening. They're giving assent to education laws in Ontario. There's been some massive changes made in education. There are now child welfare, child well-being laws that are being put in place by First Nation communities right across Canada, including from BC all the way. And those have to be approved and put in place and actually funded by the federal government. And so they're working on that as well. So it's not something that's in the public domain. The government of Canada, I'm always complaining about their comms, saying they should do a better job of it. But their job is to actually ensure that these things are moving forward. There's something like, 87 tables, or I don't know how many tables are set up across the country to look at the restoration of jurisdiction authority over lands, resources, and governance systems. So as those are moving forward, they're not put into the newspapers or any of those places. So the communities themselves are responsible and responsive to the government. The government's responsive to them. And the provincial government has to be engaged as well, because the province, mm-hmm. provinces in Canada are responsible for the lands. Does that make sense to you?
No, it does. And sort of bigger picture here, I understand that, 94 sort of really beefy recommendations, 94 calls to actions, they don't happen overnight. But it's also been, it's also been 6 years since the Truth and Reconciliation Commission completed its work, almost going on, 7 years now, if I can do my math properly. In 2022, it'll be 7 years. And it was interesting because I just recently read an article in The Guardian by a reporter named Tara Sutter, who has reported internationally on genocides in other countries, and she says, what has been continuously being revealed in Canada reminds her of what she's reported on, say, in Cambodia in decades past. But she says in this article that until a few weeks ago, the government had completed only 10 of the recommendations. So I just wonder, how do we really understand, when meaningful progress is being made?
I think we see it. I think we won't really understand it until we actually see healthy communities, where the addictions rates are plummeting, or, you know, they're not just changing, they're actually plummeting, where the resources are provided and housing is brought up to code and better standards. I mean, we're looking at water systems that have to be replaced and brought up to, you know, modern standards as well. So this is a massive expenditure. This is important for Canada as well. This is not an Indigenous process. Canadians mm-hmm. themselves have to be engaged in this conversation and understand that their assent is also important in many ways, because if they're going to vote for a government that's made this commitment, it means it's going to cost something. And that's always been a challenge in every place that that you do this kind of work at, because the people who are in office or in power and the elite and the highest earners aren't necessarily amenable to the idea of providing resources to make this change.
So the resources question is a really important one. I'm going to come back to it, because that's also how we can really talk about the role of the churches in reconciliation as well. But Regis, let me turn back to you here, because of course, as you know, and many listeners probably know, that in the wake of the discoveries of the unmarked graves in Canada, the United States Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, whose own family members went to Indigenous, or were sent, I should say, to Indigenous boarding schools here in the United States, in June, she announced a federal Indian boarding school initiative, and it's aiming to look at the legacy of federal boarding school policies here. And here's what she said.
Now, for the first time, this country has a cabinet secretary who is Indigenous. I come from ancestors who endured the horrors of Indian boarding school assimilation policies carried out by the same department that I now lead. The same agency that tried to eradicate our culture, our language, our spiritual practices, and our people. To address the intergenerational impact of Indian boarding schools, and to promote spiritual and emotional healing in our communities, we must shed light on the unspoken traumas of the past, no matter how hard it will be.
Regis, what do you hope comes out of this investigation and this process?
You know, this is really a profound statement by one of our own. And I think the expectations would be very much similar to what has been shared that has happened in Canada. As I stated, we do not know the full extent of the impacts, but we know the intergenerational realities that create the kind of dysfunction. Nowhere is this greater than the loss of language and the pain and the anger that comes with that. I think the hope is that in this investigation, there would be a clear record that can be utilized to address issues that relate to language and land and the governance of our sovereign nations, child welfare, health, and education, and look at how we use this to shift the paradigm to fulfill the self-determination and self-governance that can permeate all the way down to have the kind of impact that begins with healing individuals and families and communities, and as has been shared, to begin move towards healthier communities. That was the gift of our Creator for the maintenance of a healthy mind, body, and spirit. And the root cause of this kind of devastation and disruption to that kind of balance in our lives have been the boarding schools.
Mm. And as we discussed a few minutes ago, the root cause being transmitted generation through generation through generation, right? Can you just talk about that a little bit, Regis? Because I asked Cynthia the same question, but I want to hear your reflections on how it permeates families across time.
One generation subjected to the kind of heart-wrenching stories, as Mr. Jones shared, results in how individuals are able to deal with this kind of trauma or not. And their ability varies from pace to pace, from individual to individual. But nonetheless, the reality is how they cope or their inability to cope. Just like PTSD and the impact to family and spouses and children and entire communities, the cumulative effect from one generation to the next really manifests today into the kind of poverty that exists, the hunger that exists, the health disparities that exist, the manifestations into the vicious cycles of self-destruction, and ultimately the greatest tragedy today still in that kind of cumulative effect is the high suicide rates of the youngest of our children who are affected in a cumulative way from the time of their grandparents or great-grandparents who began this really unfortunate life experience.
Yeah. Well, so just to add a little bit of context to what Secretary of the Interior Howland has called for, she's launched an investigation into the legacy of Indigenous boarding schools here in the United States and wants a report by next year on those schools, including about the cemeteries and the possibilities of finding unidentified remains here in the United States. But Cynthia, I want to turn back to you. We've just got a couple of minutes left here because we've been talking about government response, but these schools were largely administered by various churches. Both the Canadian and the U.S. government paid those churches to run these schools. And I had mentioned earlier that the Catholic Church stands apart thus far in not having issued an apology, a formal apology in Canada. Even though, yes, Pope Francis will be meeting with Canadian Indigenous groups later this year. But you were talking about resources. We just got a couple of minutes left. I see here that the Canadian Catholic Church also hasn't raised, what, more than a fifth of the $25 million Canadian dollars that the church was supposed to raise, its portion, that was to be paid as compensation to survivors of the residential schools. I mean, so if resources are a key part of this, what do you make of that?
Well, we know that, Prime Minister Harper actually let the churches off the hook for that. And they only paid a very small portion of it. I think they paid about $3,000, and the community, the survivor circle itself, only received half of that. So I've already had that conversation with a number of survivors. We know that the settlement agreement was done before the conversations even happened across the country. It should have been more, and even the survivors had no real sense of how many people had been dramatically and directly affected by this. So there's a lot about this that's moving forward. The covenant, so that out of the 94 calls to action, the churches like the United Church and the Methodist Church and several other churches, the Anglican Church, have joined together to create a covenant that says we will be held accountable, and we will start to work directly in partnership with First Nation or Indigenous peoples across Canada to correct the wrongs. So we have that on the go, and I'm very much a part of that conversation as well. There's a lot that is going on that is kind of under the radar. We have many senators that are involved in reconciliation circles across Canada. There's a lot of conversations going on because people themselves in Canada want to know, what do I do? How can I contribute to this? And so I see a lot of people now having birthdays and anniversaries and saying, don't bring gifts, contribute some money to the Survivor's Circle Fund so that we can help the families and the communities back on their feet. And this is not charity or trying to, put people down again. It's more actually helping them stand up and lifting them into a better place.
Yeah. So as you said earlier, a true national action at every level, not just the government or the churches, but the people of both nations. Well, Cynthia Wesley Esquima and Regis Pecos, thank you both so much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.